It's the morning show. I'm Glenn Mobergen for Kate Archer Kent. The coming of spring is a cause for celebration for well-to-do college students who fly to Cancun, the Bahamas, or Florida to bask in the sun. But poor students not only can't afford to fly to exotic destinations, many of them can't afford to eat during the days when the campus dining hall is closed. They can't afford to take spring break, but the school forces them to take it anyway. In the second half of this show, we'll be talking with a researcher at Marquette University who says she learned of hungry students while working at UW-Madison. But first, we introduce you to Anthony Abraham Jack. He's a junior fellow at the Harvard Society of Fellows and also an assistant professor at the Harvard Graduate School of Education. His forthcoming book from the Harvard University Press is called The Privileged Poor. Now, you may have also seen his recent op-ed in the New York Times. It's hard to be hungry on spring break. So we'd like to hear from you. What's your experience when you were going to school? Did you experience hunger at all? Have you skipped meals because you didn't have money for groceries? Who helped you when you were hungry? Did people look at you differently? Did you have to hide the fact that you didn't have food? And do you see scraping by in college as a rite of passage, or does everybody deserve necessities like enough to eat? If you'd like to comment, give us a call at 1-800-642-1234. That's 1-800-642-1234. Or you can email us at ideas@wpr.org, or you can tweet us at WPR Mornings. Anthony, thanks so much for being with us this morning. And do you prefer being called Anthony or Tony?
Thank you for having me. Tony is fine.
All right, we'll call you Tony. Your research touches on food insecurity. You're also writing a book called The Privileged Poor. Tell us about the book, if you could, and what that title means.
Yeah, the book interrogates a simple but complex question. What does it mean to be a poor student on a rich campus? And I really try to shed new light on what does it mean to be comfortable engaging one's peers, one's professors, and also navigating university policies like closing the dining halls during spring break when you don't have enough money to leave a campus. And the title is purposefully oxymoronic, you know, like jumbo shrimp, because, uh-huh. You know, these students are at an elite university. And so some see them in a privileged position, a way to have this kind of like passport to upward mobility, this golden ticket, but they're still economically disadvantaged. And how does one navigate these institutions when you don't necessarily have all the necessary things for like full citizenship in the university, and also the university isn't truly ready for you to be there, even though they say they are? And so navigating that gap between access and inclusion is incredibly important. I think social scientists, but also politicians, need to pay more attention to what happens between convocation and commencement, because those 4 years determine how big of a springboard a university like Harvard or Yale or Stanford or Berkeley can be for students.
Well, you've had some personal experiences. What in this particular moment prompted you to write that op-ed in the New York Times called It's Hard to Be Hungry on Spring Break?
It was a combination of two things, separated by almost 15 years, actually. I experienced what it feels like to be on campus with a college shutting down during spring break. So I'm originally from Miami, Florida. And I actually went to Amherst College. My first flight in my life was actually to Hartford, Connecticut for my visit to Amherst College in Massachusetts. And when it came around spring break time, all of my friends were going to really cool places. In fact, some of them were going to Miami. I was going to the gym to work extra hours to make up money for meals that I would have to put on my credit card during spring break so I could actually make enough money to feed myself because Valentine Hall closed. And the only eatery that was open was a pay where you had to pay like the university version of Starbucks, where you actually had to pay for the food. And so everything was shut down. There were no real facilities open except for the gym, and there was just no food that was covered by like our meal plan until my junior year when I lobbied the college president.
What was the quality of the food at the one place that was open?
I mean, it was basically sausage, egg, and cheese McMuffins. It was, you can get a yogurt, but it was a lot of sodas, juices, and breakfast sandwiches like that. But even then, that would cost you probably like $10 to get a sandwich and a drink for breakfast. And if you didn't have $10 to spend already, you weren't going to spend $10 on a meal that would only last you 2 or 3 hours. You would try to take the bus all the way, what, about a mile and a half up the road, up a hill, to go to the grocery store and try to bring stuff back. But if you didn't have a fridge, like many of us didn't, or access to a kitchen, you didn't have the ability to store food, let alone cook it. But also, this spring break, we experienced a nor'easter. And at Harvard, where I currently teach, and I lobbied the institution to open the dining halls for the first time about in 2015, but they switched to a voucher system this year where students got Crimson Cash, so money on their Harvard ID, to go to restaurants. But we were in the midst of a nor'easter where restaurants were closed and streets were not safe to walk down. So if you didn't have food already, there was no way that food can get to you or that you can get to it. And I was just in this moment of like, why are we still fighting the same battle that I had to face in undergrad? And I graduated college in 2007, you know, so that I've already done my 10-year reunion. And I'm like, why are we still fighting this?
So you had access to this card from Harvard, but it didn't do you any good.
So students this year had access to Crimson Cash, which is like money on your Harvard ID that some local restaurants accept. But you have to go out and get it because no one was delivering and no one was able to really walk to the street. So if you didn't have food in your dorm this year, current students, you really didn't have access to food for about 24 to 36 hours. And so I was like, you know what? I'm going to go ahead and do this. I'm going to go ahead with it. And so I used the evidence from my research for the privileged poor to write the story to educate and maybe not really educate, just to really show people what is the reality of spring break for today's college student, because it's not all fun in the sun.
What regret do students, lower income students, have that you've talked to about spring break as their friends are jetting off to these warmer climates?
You know, I talked to 103 students as part of the book. And 76 of them were lower income students. And the students who I talked to did not mention their peers' destination as the biggest problems they faced during spring break. Those 76 students talked to me about having to ration food, having to steal food from the cafeteria, having to pool together and save up money and work extra hours so they can buy as much food as possible and live off increasingly stale loaves of bread and peanut butter and other things like that. People didn't mention like, oh, I'm really sad because my friend is going to Jamaica for spring break. They mentioned the fact that they were about to go hungry.
Tell us some specific stories, at least one right now before we take a break. One of the students that you talked to whose story seems to sum up the concerns you have on this issue.
Yeah. So what's interesting is Michelle, who faced homelessness before coming to college, she went to a local soup kitchen because that's what she learned to do when her family was out of food when she was in New York. And so she incorporated that strategy at her elite college. And just think about that. That her strategy from being homeless actually was an appropriate strategy for navigating an elite university because of this oversight in closing the dining hall.
Now, you also wrote that there was a woman who actually went on a dating site looking for young men who would take her out for dinner.
Yes. There was one student who mentioned that in the lead up to spring break, she would increase her online dating activity. And in that conversation, when she asked a question at a talk that I gave, it was banking on gender norms of men paying for the first meal, that she's lined up dates during spring break so that she could at least have a steady source of food coming in every day.
Well, she'd probably be disappointed if she went out on that date and the guy said, look, I'm a liberated young man. This is Dutch treat.
That and, but I was, you know, it's funny. I thought more about the concern of safety of the students who would lead, who would use sites like this, because if the person on the other end of the table sensed any kind of ulterior motive and why they were seeking the date or why they were on the date, I always feared that the student would be either found out and what that person would do to them in a response to that.
Tony, we've got to take a quick break. We're going to pick up on this when we come back. Anthony Abraham Jack is an assistant professor at the Harvard Graduate School of Education. His forthcoming book is called The Privileged Poor, examining what it means to be poor on a rich college campus. It's The Morning Show. I'm Glenn Mobergen for Kate Archer Kent. We'll continue our conversation in just a bit, but first this news. It's The Morning Show. I'm Glenn Mobergen for Kate Archer Kent. We're talking about what it means to be a poor student on a rich college campus and to have to scrounge for food during spring break when the campus cafeteria is closed. Our guest, Anthony Abraham Jack. He's an assistant professor at the Harvard Graduate School of Education. His forthcoming book from the Harvard University Press is called The Privileged Poor, and you may have seen his recent op-ed in the New York Times, It's Hard to Be Hungry on Spring Break. So we want to hear from you. Did you experience hunger while going to school? Have you skipped meals because you didn't have money for groceries? Who helped you when you were hungry? Did people look at you differently, your fellow students? And do you see scraping by in college as a rite of passage? 1-800-642-1234, 1-800-642-1234. You can email us at ideas@WPR.org or tweet us at WPR Mornings. Let's go right to the phones. We have Chris in Toma. Chris, you are on The Morning Show with Anthony.
Good morning. Great show. Yeah, I was a working poor college student and worked full-time night shift, went to school full-time during the day, could only afford a two-meal meal plan, so I took three hard-boiled eggs and two apples from the cafeteria every morning so that I would have lunch. And then, you know, I was also raising a family, and so I visited the food pantry. Luckily, UW-Oshkosh, fine institution, has a lot of international students, so they have a cafeteria that's open throughout every break.
Well, it sounds, Chris, like your experience was different than a lot of your fellow students. You not only didn't have enough money, but you were raising a family. How did your fellow students look at you?
They helped out a lot. Several of my classmates babysat for me at night when I was at work and didn't charge me a penny.
Well, good for them, and good for you as well. Glad to hear your story. Anthony Abraham Jack, could you weigh in on what Chris just said?
Yeah, no, I'm really happy that that your classmates were able to support you in that way and supporting families, because the number of students and are working full-time and are working parents, especially at state and community colleges, and to have that support. I'm also glad that your institution was one that actually supported international students, because in the research I actually found that some places didn't do that either, that even if they had a significant portion of international students, one school literally has on their website a quote saying, because Americans typically go on vacation during spring break, we close. And so that kind of assumption that everybody can, even our international students, is one that I hope people start to interrogate in a more serious way. But I'm glad that your institution at least kept one cafeteria open to support everyone.
Tony, the title of your new book, The Privileged Poor, as I understand it, it refers to kids who not only are in college, but they came from an underprivileged background, and they ended up, for one reason or another, being able to go to private high schools. Could you contrast their experience going to a private high school with other students from poor neighborhoods who ended up going instead to poorly funded public schools, and the difference between their experience and the experience of the so-called privileged poor?
Yes. I should say the book is called Privileged Poor for that very reason. My research introduced a new group of students into our knowledge base for what does it mean to be poor in on a college campus. So what I uncovered is that on average, 50% of the lower income black student at elite schools actually graduate from boarding day and preparatory high schools like Exeter and Andover, right? And they're economically disadvantaged, but they have access to dominant cultural capital that we love to, that term that we love to go around, meaning that they're familiar with elite environments. And I call those students the privileged poor because you don't expect a poor black student or a poor Latino student or a poor white student to go to a boarding school that costs $55,000. Their experience is very different from the group I call the doubly disadvantaged, lower income students who go to typically distressed high schools and then make that huge leap to go to college. And so I compare and contrast their experiences. And what I really find out is the privileged poor, those lower income students who go to private school, are more familiar and comfortable with navigating the social side of campus life. They're more comfortable with their professors. They're more comfortable with being around wealthy white peers. And so they're used to Canada Goose jackets that cost $750. They're used to conversations about vacations on the vineyard or, you know, private jets. But what my research on spring break kind of brings our attention back to is that both groups, no matter what type of high school they graduated from, are still economically disadvantaged. And so they both face the obstacle of not having enough money to leave campus for spring break or being able to have to pay, like some colleges do, to remain in their rooms. And so by contrasting and comparing where their experiences align, I show where social class, i.e. money, and culture, as in familiarity with elite environments, shapes students' experiences.
Well, let's talk about culture for just a bit. The tendency mm-hmm. to assume extends beyond issues of food security to other areas of college. You mentioned the concept of office hours. A lot of poor students don't even understand something that's, just commonplace knowledge for many of us who went to higher education institutions, the idea that a teacher would have office hours in which you could go and visit them and sit down and chat. The poor students weren't even aware of that.
Exactly. One of my biggest pet peeves is, and I'm on a one-man campaign, and I love people to join me, we never define what office hours are. 9 times out of 10, we say when office hours are. But if you did not go to a secondary institution that had a time in which a teacher specifically sets out a portion of their schedule to meet with students about any and everything, you are not comfortable with the term, let alone having practice to master the strategies and the that you need to navigate office hours. Like, office hours is not a term that is well known across the United States. You have to attend a certain type of institution to have had experience with office hours. And what I find is that the privileged poor are much more at ease and even agentic in their orientation to go meet with faculty members. They go and enlist faculty members as their mentors, as their confidants, as their friends even, whereas the doubly disadvantaged believe that teachers or adults in general should be treated with deference, should be treated with respect and distance. And so they are less likely to engage faculty members, and many feel guilty for bothering a professor with their time when it is that exact thing, office hours, you're supposed to go to professors. And that is the road to letters of recommendation, introductions to headhunters, like for jobs, or just actually getting some emotional support when times get rough. And so by understanding that, it's just very important to see how culture shapes students' experience.
You know, it sounds like the privileged poor have one strike against them, the doubly disadvantaged have two strikes, and we all know that three strikes and you're out.
In some respects, I haven't thought about that particular analogy, but it is one that works, because each burden that you have to bear slows you down as you move through college. For example, I fundamentally believe that all students who are admitted to college can graduate, and not only can graduate, but can do well. It's the social hurdles that trip students up. It's these things that all these extra burdens that students have to fight and battle and overcome on a daily basis, like food insecurity, like learning this hidden curriculum that slows academically promising students down.
And, you know, the cultural thing is bad enough, but when you're hungry and you don't have to have enough to eat, that makes it even worse. How do you know that this is a widespread problem, Tony, and not just a few isolated incidents from the folks you've been talking to?
Yeah, well, two reasons. One, I did interviews at one school, but then I looked at the policy at other schools and also talked to students across the country. And so, as I was saying, like, I worked with Connecticut College to reverse their policy, because in 2015, they charged students to stay on campus. And then working with them, I helped reverse that policy. And a lot of students actually reached out and to the dean and talked about what does that mean for them. But more importantly, there are some other researchers who are beginning to pay attention to food insecurity on a college campus. And what we found is that at George Washington University, 1 in 5 of their first generation college students reported being food insecure, meaning not knowing where their next meal is coming from. In a study by the California State University, across their whole system, 21% of their students were food insecure. And Sarah Gowick Robb, who is actually producing a new study on food insecurity in the coming days or even weeks, but I think maybe in days, is producing the largest study on food insecurity among college students. Because the reality is, I study episodic food insecurity, security over Thanksgiving, spring, and winter break.
Right.
State colleges and community college students face chronic food insecurity, where this is their reality 3 or more times per week. And the data shows that this is an increasing reality at state and community colleges across the country.
Tony, thank you so much for being with us today. Anthony Abraham Jack is a junior fellow at the Harvard Society of Fellows and also an assistant professor at the Harvard Graduate School of Education. His forthcoming book about being a poor student at a rich college is called The Privileged Poor. He recently wrote an op-ed in the New York Times called It's Hard to Be Hungry on Spring Break. And now let's bring this conversation home to Wisconsin. Noreen Siddiqui is here in the Ideas Network studio with us. She's a doctoral student at Marquette University researching campus food insecurity. She became familiar with college students who didn't have enough to eat when she worked at UW-Madison. So this is kind of a call out to those of you who went through the UW system, or maybe, as Tony was just mentioning, you went to a state-run school of some sort or a community college or maybe one of our two-year colleges. Were you ever hungry when you were going to school? Have you skipped meals because you didn't have enough money for groceries? Do you have a story about food insecurity that you could share with us, or a story about people who helped you when you were hungry? Maybe it was a teacher who extended a handout, or maybe your fellow students. And some of you may see scraping by in college as just a necessary rite and passage, and you're wondering what the big to-do is here that we're talking about. One way or the other, we'd like to hear from you. Our phone lines are wide open, 1-800-642-1234. That's 1-800-642-1234. You can email us at ideas@wpr.org, or you can tweet us at WPR Mornings. Noreen, thanks so much for being with us today.
Thanks for having me.
What did you hear? What did you think of Anthony's story? You were listening to it with the rest of us here in the studio.
Yeah, it's unfortunately a pretty common story. And actually, his research, he came to Wisconsin a few years ago to talk about this. So it's really exciting to see that he has a book coming out that's going to bring everything that he's been talking about and looking at the last few years together.
So you were familiar with some of his work prior to coming today. You've helped pilot a new program at UW-Madison as part of a push to address food insecurity on that campus. What started this conversation with you?
So for me personally, I started working in the Dean of Students as a student assistant specialist. And within that role, I would meet with students who were dealing with food insecurity. The office actually has a crisis loan program. So any student who is dealing with a crisis can come in and apply for a crisis loan. And so with those conversations with students, I began to see that there were quite a number of students who were food insecure. But then working with this new program, Badger Fair, that was really the brainchild of Martin Rouse, who works in adult, career, and special student services. And so working with him, we were able to launch this program that can immediately assist students who are saying that I don't have enough to eat, while connecting them with long-term resources.
And you're doing research on this at Marquette University.
Correct.
What made this get really high on your priority list of things to do?
Sure. So my interest in this area actually started when I was an academic advisor at Oregon State University, and just talking to students in particular. I remember one student who felt like he could tell me that he didn't have enough to eat. And so I remember having a few conversations with him to convince him that using the campus resources, because we had a really great campus food pantry on that campus and lots of resources for students, that would be beneficial to him. And another student who was couch surfing. So that literally means he didn't have a permanent place to stay and was just staying with friends. And so to me, that showed the extremeness of what was happening and really first got me interested in this. But in each position that I've had since then, it's just become a larger and larger issue of the students that I meet with. And so it really showed to me that this is a growing problem. And Sarah Goldrick-Grab, which Dr. Abraham Jack had mentioned, she has been doing this research. And so her research pretty much came out within the last 10 years, and that really piqued my interest as well.
Well, let's talk about couch surfing. I mean, mm-hmm. if you don't have a permanent place to stay, and you're basically sleeping on couches or maybe on the floor at your friends' houses, what kind of a background is that in order to do the extremely competitive work that you have to do in order to graduate from a higher education institution?
Exactly. It's incredibly challenging. And these students, honestly, they usually don't consider themselves as not having housing. They think of it as, well, I've got a place to stay, so that's okay. And that's all that I need right now. But of course, that's not going to be a conducive environment for them to be successful academically, to be able to focus. They're, you know, worrying, even though this is probably a friend they're staying with, that this friend's generosity may not last.
And then suddenly you've got no place to stay,
exactly.
No place to put your books, no desk to read from. Tough life if you're in college.
Definitely.
We are talking about the gap between rich and poor on our college campuses today, and our guest for the remainder of the hour is Noreen Siddiqui. She's a doctoral student at Marquette University researching campus food insecurity. She became familiar with college students who didn't have enough to eat when she worked at UW-Madison. It's The Morning Show. I'm Glenn Mobergen for Kate Archer Kent. We'll have much more in just a bit, but first, this news. I'm Glenn Mobergen for Kate Archer Kent. We are talking about the gap between rich and poor on college campuses with Noreen Siddiqui. She's a doctoral student at Marquette University researching campus food insecurity. And she helped come up with a program called Badger Fair in order to address some of those concerns. We'd like to hear from you if you experienced hunger while going to school, or you knew people who did. Maybe you were one of those people who were couch surfing, just living from one apartment to another because you couldn't afford a place to stay yourself. Or maybe you see scraping by in college as a rite of passage and something that affects everyone. 1-800-642-1234. 1-800-642-1234. You can email us at ideas@WPR.org, or you can tweet us at WPR Mornings. Maureen, tell us a little bit about your research.
Sure. So right now I'm looking at private institutions because a lot of the research has focused on public institutions with you know, good reason, because especially community colleges, I definitely wouldn't argue with the fact that they probably are going to have the highest rates of food insecure students. But with the exclusion of private schools, it's really left the impression that this isn't an issue there. And I just got my preliminary data back from my first survey of a private university, and I've been pretty shocked by the results so far.
Well, tell us what the results are.
So the big kind of overarching USDA survey, which tells you is someone food insecure or not, it showed that over 50% of my respondents were food insecure by this.
Over half the students don't have enough to eat?
Yeah.
Are you sure that's accurate?
So I haven't done the statistical analysis to say how that relates to the standard population of the university that I did my research at, but based on the respondents that I had, that's the data that I have. And so I was shocked. I was not expecting nearly as high as that amount. But as your previous guest mentioned, really when you look at the research on public institutions, the range is between 1 in 5 to 3 in 5 students. So it does fall within that range.
Let's talk about public schools, since Tony in the first half of the show talked a great deal about Harvard and some of the private schools. You worked at UW-Madison, and while you haven't done research on UW-Madison, you certainly have a lot of anecdotal evidence that this is a problem. Talk about that.
Yes. So, like I mentioned, working with the crisis loan program, we would meet with students and learn really about their situation of why they were in that crisis situation. And so for some students, it was literally they are just able to make ends meet, and then something happens to pretty much throw them off their stride. And so an example would be, you know, a student who is working and has their car breakdown. They now have a $500 repair bill they need to pay, and they need that to get to work. And if they have no backup system, no safety net, you know, their parents can't pitch in. Oftentimes these students are actually sending money back to help support their families. And so that just throws them into a tailspin of how do I pay for this repair and still have money for books, money to eat, to pay my rent and all my other bills.
Well, when you've got a lot of people in Wisconsin who are just struggling day to day, I mean, the adult population, you know, one paycheck, one problem away from disaster, that's certainly going to trickle down to the kids.
Absolutely.
And they've got these kids in school that they're hoping they'll get a better life than the one they have. And the students just don't have the resources that they need.
Correct. And that is where Sarah Goldrick-Grab's research really has shown that the FAFSA program, so our financial aid system through the government, really is broken, because it always assumes that when we're looking at students' finances, that parents are either able to contribute or just not contribute at all. It doesn't look at students contributing back to their families. And for many students who are coming from low socioeconomic backgrounds, before starting college, they've been contributing to their family. And so it is a loss to the family when these students start school and they take their income earning ability with them.
Right. So. Well, let's talk about this program you came up with, Badger Fair. Tell us exactly how the program works. How does it get food in front of hungry college students?
Sure. So the whole idea of this program was that when a faculty member or staff member is meeting with a student and they realize that this student may not have anything in their fridge right now to eat, and they have no money for the rest of the week or the rest of the month to be able to purchase more food, it's really hard to say to that student, well, here's a list of resources and, you know, good luck. A lot of times, you know, people want to do something immediately. And so this program is able to give faculty and staff that ability to respond immediately by putting a dining card into that student's hand for $25. It's preloaded so they can go to one of the unions and get food immediately. But within that, they're getting that packet of resources as well to say, this is a short stopgap, but we want you to connect with long-term resources.
You know, people generally still look down on others who don't have the means to feed themselves. How does this program preserve a student's dignity?
Yeah, that was key. That term dignity is something that I think about whenever we're trying to address food insecurity, because there is such a stigma with being food insecure, and going into a food pantry can be really hard if you have never done that before, or even if you have. And so this program, the dining cards look like any other dining cards that someone would receive if they are, you know, there at the union for an event. And they are, instead of catering, the program is like, we're going to give every attendant a dining card so that they can just go get a meal.
What's the response been from students?
Overwhelmingly positive so far. We have had a couple issues with the card, so that is something that I know the current person working with Badger Fair is looking to fix so that we don't have any of those. But students, I've heard from you know, the people who have been actually handing out the cards, they've had students cry in their office when they've gotten one of these cards because they're just, you know, so grateful. And in a lot of ways that feels good, but in a lot of ways that feels really, really sad.
Yeah.
'Cause it's $25 and most people don't think of that as being hardly anything. And yet for these students, that means that they can eat.
You've also connected students with crisis loans. What are those loans and how do they relate to the whole issue of college students not having enough to eat?
Sure. So crisis loans are available for students to apply for, and they're interest-free loans is the main thing. So these are offered through the university up to $500. Students need to pay them back within 6 months. So it isn't, unfortunately, it isn't a grant. But we get into other issues. If we start giving out grants of that size, then it can start influencing students' financial aid packages. But with the loan, this way we can get money into students' hands fairly quickly. It's usually a 24-hour period in which they can get a check written for them. So it's a lot easier than going to a bank. It's a lot easier than, well, I shouldn't say easier. It's a lot more affordable than putting something on your credit card. So
how do you respond to people who question whether students should, you know, doggone it, they should just take responsibility for feeding themselves? If they can go to college, they ought to find a way to afford food. Work two jobs, work three jobs, do whatever it takes.
Sure. And my response would be, these students are already doing that oftentimes. They are already working multiple jobs. And the idea that education, especially college, is an opportunity for people to advance themselves, to pull themselves out of poverty, that premise has to be supported by the idea that you don't have to be secure food financially, you know, to be able to buy your food to be in college. Because otherwise we're saying that you have to be middle class or upper class to come to school.
To go to college. Mm-hmm. So you're saying that ignoring the issue of hunger at college sends the message that college isn't for everyone.
Exactly.
A multi-state study last year from the Wisconsin Hope Lab reveals that one-third of community college students are experiencing food or housing insecurity, and they were both working and receiving financial aid. But what about those stories that people ate cheap ramen noodle meals for years just to get through college?
Sure. And I did that as well, you know, over a decade ago when I was in college. And really, one of the issues is the rising cost of college itself. So it used to be where you could, you know, work a job or two jobs during the summer, make enough money to pay for the next year's tuition and books and everything. And that's just not the case anymore. And financial aid, unfortunately, hasn't really kept up with that demand, Pell Grants especially, where we're saying that here is, you know, it's money to go to school, but oftentimes it just gets shuffled around between how much is given in loan and how much is given in grant, so that the overall total that students are getting is not covering their needs.
And it's it's a serious problem, and it's one that's not going away anytime fast. But thank you for trying to do something about it.
Thank you.
Thank you, Noreen. Noreen Siddiqui is a doctoral student at Marquette University researching campus food insecurity. She became familiar with college students who didn't have enough to eat when she worked at UW-Madison. Earlier, we spoke with Harvard Junior Fellow and Associate Professor Anthony Abraham Jack about his New York Times op-ed about students who go hungry during spring break. His forthcoming book is called The Privileged Poor. This hour of the morning show was produced by Keely Baltina. Michael Derringer provided technical direction. Michelle Johnson is our executive producer. Coming up tomorrow at this time, it's been 5 years since an influential book encouraged women everywhere to lean in at their jobs. Our guest argues that women today should challenge the power structure instead of trying to fit into it. I'm Glenn Moberg, and for Kate Archer Kent, it's the morning show on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.